topics today, both related to public safety. First, we're going to hear a report and update on our intelligence-led policing, and then we'll have some discussion as far as some staffing needs for police and fire, and what we might do to gather some information preparatory to the budget process that we'll be heading into here in a couple of months. So, intelligence-led policing, Chief Peterson, are you going to lead that, or?
Okay. I am. Briefly introduce it.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Appreciate it. I will be very brief. We have some other folks in the department. I think the more people you hear from in the different facets, probably the more valuable it will be for you. If you recall back 5 years ago now, we had a discussion on intelligence-led policing and how technology could leverage what we're doing on the department under actually a pretty simple philosophy. That is that a small number of people are responsible for a large amount of crime in any given community. The number actually comes out to about 6% of offenders being responsible for 60% of the crime that occurs. And so based on that, we felt our best opportunity to leverage a reduction in crime is to be able to focus our resources on those people that are most responsible for it. I'm not going to give you a lot of numbers. Personally, you're going to see a lot of numbers, but overall, I think certainly the numbers support what we've been trying to accomplish. The crime rates in Rochester are down to historically low levels. I think I provided that information to you previously in a department update. That's not, of course, the whole story. And in order for you to get more of that perspective, as I said, we're going to give you kind of an overview from a couple of different people. Tim Haroff is going to give you that historical, more strategic perspective. He's been working with this project since its inception. Joe Contra is here to give you the crime analyst perception, that is to give you specific examples when I tell you about concentrating on our most prolific offenders and how that's working and what impact that actually has. He'll provide you some examples, specific examples of that, so you can see what that, how that is working in our community. And Captain Wellenen is here from the patrol division to talk about how this is impacting patrol and other issues that we're looking at going forward. So with that introduction, we obviously have quite a bit to talk about, and we don't want to inundate you with the numbers or one perspective, so I'm going to ask Tim Haroff to give you that kind of overall strategic view, and we'll get more specifics from there.
Thanks, Chief. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you a little bit this morning about, or this afternoon, about intelligence-led policing, because I think we have a really interesting story to tell. We adopted intelligence-led policing as a business philosophy back in 2010 as the result of a spree of drive-by shootings that really kind of shook our community. And we realized at that time that we were not going to be able to continue to do business the same way that we've always done business. Intelligence-led policing is really a business managerial philosophy that's based on the realization that you need to focus those scarce resources that you have available to you. So the definition of intelligence-led policing, roughly, is that it's a business philosophy that uses crime analysis and criminal intelligence to develop an objective basis upon which to make decisions that reduce, disrupt, and most importantly, prevent crime. And you use those techniques in a strategic management fashion across the enterprise in order to focus your resources on your most prolific and serious offenders. And there's some academic research that really is the underpinning of this philosophy, the fact that 6% of your criminals are responsible for about 60% of your crime. We crunched the numbers here in Rochester, and we found that 6% of our criminals were responsible for about 52% of the crime in Rochester. With the limited set of resources. It was really necessary for us to look at how we did business and fundamentally shift the way that we thought about policing, that we needed to focus on this prevention aspect, specifically regarding those individuals. So in 2010, we restructured our department. We, in 2011, purchased a product from IBM called InfoSphere Identity Insight. As you know, the police department has invested heavily in technology over the years, and it's done really well for us. Identity Insight helps us to understand who's who. It does entity resolution, and it also helps us to understand the non-obvious relationship associations, that spider web of interactions between individuals who are involved in crime. And so that's kind of a people-centric approach that's really somewhat different than what a lot of police agencies have taken across the United States. Historically, police departments have looked at the geospatial aspect of crime mapping. Where are the hotspots? Where are the points that we need to put police officers? We decided to go in a little different route based on that research that had been conducted in the mid-2000s. So we implemented Identity Insight. It worked really quite well for us. We were able to start changing the culture of the police department. In 2014, we also purchased a product from IBM called SPSS, the Statistical Package for the Social Sciences. I've conducted a number of presentations on this topic at different conferences around the United States and Canada over the last several years. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be traveling to Washington, D.C. to present to a panel of the National Academies of Science on this topic as well. When I do that, I'd like to take you back to 1829, the London Metropolitan Police Department, Sir Robert Peel, the reason why police officers in London are called bobbies, Sir Robert Peel. He's credited with starting the first truly professional modern police agency. Sir Robert Peel had 9 different principles. Principle number 1 was the mission of a police agency is to prevent crime. It's not for us to get really good at answering that 911 call and getting there and collecting evidence and figuring out who committed the crime. Our purpose really needs to be to prevent the crime from happening in the first place. The second principle, which I find really interesting because it's as pertinent today as it was in 1829, is that for any law enforcement agency to be effective, you must have the support of your community. You must be supported by your community. So in 2014, when we purchased SPSS and we started talking about some of the predictive analytics that we could do with that product, there were members of our community that expressed concern about how we would use that tool. And much to Chief Peterson's credit, at about that same time, he actually started engaging members of our community in a task force to talk about how we should deliver policing services in Rochester. Now, this was long before Ferguson. It was before a lot of the unrest that occurred over the course of the last year. We wanted to make sure, before we went down that path of predictive policing, that we had the support of our community. And when we started hearing some concerns, we set that product on the shelf and we said, we're not going to do that until we get the Police Policy Oversight Commission in place and we can have some dialogue, some meaningful discussion about how the members of this community want to be policed. And so now we have that commission in place, and thanks to the mayor, I know that took a lot of work to get all of those folks vetted. I think we have a great group of individuals who will be able to help us review police policy moving forward. We look forward to the opportunity to start looking at other innovative ways that we can prevent crime from happening and at the same time enjoy the support of our community. So we, as I mentioned, we've invested heavily in technology, but really where the rubber meets the road is in the culture of the department. I'm really pleased at how we've been able to shift the focus or shift the way the police officers approach their jobs. Moving culture in a heavily tradition-laden organization is not an easy task, and we've been pretty successful in that. And so later in the presentation, you'll hear from Joe some details about how we're accomplishing some of the more technical aspects, and Captain Moylan will tell you a little bit more about the culture shift that we've seen in this organization as well. So that just kind of sets the stage for the things that you're going to hear next. Now, all of you have been part of this council since we started this program, so I felt it was important that you have some basic fundamental understandings there. So that's my piece.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Conker. I'm the crime analyst with the Rochester Police Department. And as you can see, kind of our agenda on the screen behind me, I'll move out of the way and probably stand up if that's all right. I'm the third up here, and I'm going to talk to you more about the nuts and bolts of what we've accomplished and try and quantify some of the things that we've talked about doing. I echo the sentiments that you've heard already that I think this agency has made some cultural changes. We are looking at our problems more strategically. And so I'll try and support that with some numbers and do what I can from the data side. That's kind of my role at the department. And then Captain Moylan will share some of the experience on the street. Overall, just to sort of sum up where we're at, by most of our measures, our crime control strategy appears to be working. The police don't ever want to take credit for, because the things that create crime are bigger than us. If we're taking credit when things are good, we might not want to take credit when things aren't doing as well. So things are. I will show you some numbers that show that our crime control policy appears to be working. We are continuing this incremental implementation of intelligence-led policing. It's small steps. It's not big. The technology is a little bit the catalyst, and we've been really successful with this. I think some of the key things, especially you heard from Captain Mullen, are that the officers on the street have a much better situational awareness. The department understands that small group of people who commit inordinate amount of crime. We're much more aware of those people, which helps us build better relationships with different agencies that are interested in public safety and ultimately keep the community safer. And again, I think what you're going to see here hopefully is some evidence of this third point, that RPD is becoming more introspective and analytical. We're looking at how can we give the community the biggest bang for their policing dollar and do it in a way that's respectful and responsible. We are doing a lot of technology. That's why we're here. We've made some commitments to technology, and that is really the catalyst for this cultural change, which will give us a lot bigger dividends than the technology in and of itself. So. That's kind of the phase we're in right now. We're working on a lot of the technology, figuring out how it fits into our organization the best. But at this time, it's really been the catalyst for how we look at our problems and how we look at service delivery. Some of those things that come out of that right now to show that are our resource demand sprawl and our response time concerns. And then kind of something that fell out of that was a concern that we're finding our officers don't have the time to be as proactive as they were in the past, which obviously creates some current concern for us down the road. So I'll share some of the data behind that. As I said, in general, our crime numbers are going the right direction by most accounts. There are certain types of crimes are up, but most right now, most concern is quality of life violations that do require a lot of neighborhood policing. They do require officers to be proactive, provide extra patrol, build relationships, and deal with problems. When it comes to actual intrusive property crimes, up here you've got theft from motor vehicle. These are car prowls. And as you can see, the 12-month average, which is the white line, it has come down since the beginning of this tracking, which is September 2010. So over the last 5 years, we've seen a relative decline. And that's certainly a good thing, because no one wants to wake up and find their car's been ripped apart and their cell phone's gone. The bottom is burglary. Burglaries have gone down. You can get in this yellow line is your 12-month moving average. And again, we did have quite the burglar this spring, if you followed the news. That was kind of an anomaly to our trend of otherwise. Last summer, we went without a month of over 43, I believe, burglaries. So we didn't have our normal summer spike, as you can kind of see from the data in the past. So that was an amazing thing, and it really helped our rolling average. But as you can see, in general, things are going the right direction. One example, this is an example that I think is a really great example of intelligence-led policing applied. This is our prolific shoplifter strategy. And this is where the agency has a top-down approach to dealing with a certain problem that's creating a lot of crime in the community. Shoplifting is one of the most prolific crimes there is in any city of this size. We have a huge amount of shoplifting going on at retail stores. And the penalty for shoplifting is low. What we found through our understanding of the problem is that a lot of repeat shoplifters are doing it to finance their narcotics habits. There's an underlying problem that's creating all this crime that creates business hours spent, you know, gets lost to the business, and it creates a lot of effort by the police department to write every one of those reports up that ends up in a misdemeanor citation that doesn't go very far to dealing with the actual problem. So looking at that and looking at what our options are, what we've come up with is a solution. It's kind of a three-pronged solution. We've worked with loss prevention because they're key in this. They're a business. And the loss prevention, we've worked to get our officers to really help out the loss prevention understand that we want to trespass. We want them to trespass repeat shoplifters. So if someone comes and shoplifts once, okay, they come and do it again, you don't want them on your property. That's a problem for them. And so hopefully we're seeing more and more businesses want to trespass repeat shoplifters. That gives us a lot of leverage. If they do return after being trespassed, and now we're talking about the third or fourth offense, they return to the same store to do the same crime, they're going to get charged with a felony versus a misdemeanor. We've also aggregated those multiple charges across many different stores across Rochester and Olmsted County, where we can aggregate those into a gross misdemeanor and a felony level. And we've ensured that there's some other, if you use tools to steal, there's some other statutes that are felony level that we can use to charge repeat shoplifters with that we just maybe haven't done a very good job of in the past of finding those and using this as a tool to deal with the underlying problem, which is what intelligence-led policing is all about. And that's all this crime that's being committed by this really small group of people. And it is small when you look at the numbers. But we have, this is an effective strategy where we've actually resulted in, so far this year, 14 burglaries have been charged out, and that's only half of a year. We've charged out 14 burglaries for people who are repeat shoplifters, and about all of them are there's an underlying narcotics problem. And how we go about dealing with this is that now those people are going to go in front of a judge because they're facing a felony who's going to have the leverage to give them treatment. And if this is their first time in front of the judge, they're going to have a really good good chance of going to treatment. And if they are successful, we've created a lot of reduced crime just by taking this sort of proactive approach to the situation. And if they continue to commit crime, well, then they're going to face those longer sentences, and that's going to reduce crime as well. So that's kind of our strategy as far as our shoplifter strategy, and that's a good, I think, example of the sort of strategic implementation of ILP on a day-to-day basis. Some numbers as far as our total, our service demand and delivery. I'll start in the middle here of our total numbers. And you can see over the last 5 years, there's not a very significant change in our total call for service demand. Those are relatively stagnant. What's very interesting about this is this column, our non-officer initiated call for service. And that is where we are losing some traction. We're actually having more non-officer initiated. So a call where someone calls into our dispatch center and says, hey, we need police service. We're actually having more of those. Those are growing. We've grown those every year, it appears, and are on track to continue that growth. So what that results in is what this data shows here. We're conducting fewer traffic stops and fewer officer-initiated calls every year since then, more or less. We have, again, if you just look at 2015 or 2014, versus 2011, we're going to conduct probably, we conducted about 2,000 less traffic stops, or 1,500 less traffic stops. Those are the places where we get to be proactive. We get to interdict. We get to respond to neighborhood concerns. Those are the things, that's where we could really help out and deal with those community issues. And as I mentioned earlier, that's really our biggest problem right now is those quality of life, animals, neighborhood noise complaints, problem houses, rental property issues. That's where the police are really, there's a lot of high demand in the neighborhoods right now. And those things take time. And as you're seeing up here, because this non-officer initiated category is growing, our officers are less able to be proactive and try and solve problems before they come up. Another thing worth noting is that our two officer calls for service have increased from about 23% in 2011, on track to be around 26% this year. So that's the calls where we have to have two officers respond. And again, that's tying up extra resources. And again, probably one of the reasons why we see these officer-initiated calls decreasing. We're with the same resources, so we're seeing more pressure on the officers to respond to calls versus be proactive and deal with problems. And probably the most concerning statistic I'll bring up here is our overall response time. We've got our average overall response time to a priority one call has gone up from, in 2011, 5 minutes and 52 seconds to 6 minutes and 23 seconds projected for this year, or as of 2 days ago this year. And our average medical response times mirror that as well, that slow march upward in response time. So those are the statistics that pretty much bear out what we're saying, that we are struggling to get to things as fast as we'd like to, and that trend looks like it's going to continue. There's no information here that shows that we're not going to be responding slower next year. And what some of this looks like on maps now, I'm a geography major, so I like to show maps for sure. What you can see is this is a map on the left, shows our overall calls for service demand between 2012, 2013, 2014. So it's a huge set of data, over 2,000 points. And it just shows you where our highest demand is. Our highest demand, obviously, is in our urban core in Rochester. But we also have really sprawled out regions you have the Manor. It continues to grow south, continues to grow north and west, but also north and east. And then, of course, going east too. So we're really pulled every direction, and Rochester's geography is not compact. It's elongated. And so that makes it a trouble. But that's just our general, that's where our calls for service are overall. On the right side of the screen, this is a comparison of 2011 calls for service volume versus 2014. So it's 2011 versus last year's total calls for service in each of our police response areas. And they show you the change. What you can see is our, generally in the southeast quadrant of the town, we have general reductions in the calls for service load. But we do have, otherwise, we have it sprawling out. We have a lot of growth up northwest, a lot of growth straight out to the west in the Manor area, in the southwest area. Those are areas that are growing. So again, we're being pulled, and we also have growth downtown too. So it's not like it's all growth on the fringes. It's growth in both in the center and on the elongated side. So it's not only that our numbers are increasing, our demand is increasing, it's that the location is sprawling. So here's a map of response times based on our different response areas. Again, those same areas that were on the last slide. And you can see I've got 2015 current statistics, so that's about a half year's worth of data, but I also provide 2014 in case there is any concern that that's not a full sample. The data is relatively similar. There's ups and downs, but in general, the further away you get from the core, the longer your response time is going to be. And these are just for medical calls, so these would be the calls generally where we're trying to get there as fast as we can. And so again, you see that northwest, southwest, west, and the southeast, where we're actually losing demand for call for service, our response times are increasing as well. So the concern there is that we are shifting our resources, and yet now we're kind of seeing a growth in response times in those areas that actually are not needing as much service. So there's definitely some concern there. The wide variety of times. On the left, we have that same data, instead of done at the police response area, which is, of course, interesting to us, but maybe not as good for the whole audience. This is by a census block group. It starts to struggle with a small population problem. That's what this is, two calls for service out here in the Manor that kind of create an anomaly. But in general, you see the general pattern that the further you get from the core, the higher the response times, with a few exceptions. Fire station up here is obviously a good staging point for a lot of RPD officers, and so the response times are generally lower along 37th Street and 41st Street area. And then this map is a spatial interpolation map of our response time. Just show you a couple of the hot spots. They kind of come out a little bit better that way. And this is like if you've ever seen a lake map, they take a bunch of sonar readings and then they try and create contour lines to show the response time length. And you can see, again, really our highest response times, again, out in the Manor, southwest, northwest, and again, heading out to the south and east. And then one thing that this has kind of resulted in, and I'll invite Captain Moylan to talk about the impact on the patrol division, is that this was last Wednesday when we had two significant incidents occurring at the same time. We had a home invasion burglary and a assault with weapons occurring at the same time, and we had these are all our units, and they show that all the RPD squads are actually assigned to a call at the time. There's no one available, and we have numerous calls holding, but most concerning is that we have a medical call holding for at least 3 minutes. Apologies that the screenshot isn't the greatest there, but it does say about 3 minutes of wait time on that medical call. And so that's what it took to overflow our resources, was two significant incidents with weapons. We had all our squads assigned, and we were left with a medical call holding. So that's kind of a place where I don't think anyone wants to be. And with that, I'll, pending any questions, I'll turn it over to Captain Marlin.
All right, thank you.
Joe did a nice job of bringing up some of the issues that I wanted to talk about. I'll try to be brief because I know your time is limited, and I appreciate the time that you've given us to meet with you on these issues. There's no doubt that intelligence-led policing and the investment that the city has made in technology in that regard has definitely helped in reducing violent crime. We've got the information, we know who the prolific offenders are, we know the crimes that they commit, and we have serious crimes. We've got great information to work with and to follow up on. We know who's associated with who, and things like that. So for the violent crime investigations, we can do a pretty good job. And I think you've seen that with those crime statistics decreasing. Where we lack is the resources to handle those minor issues, the neighborhood issues, the traffic problems. I mean, the last slide there was, I think, three accidents that were holding for over an hour, another one that was holding for almost an hour. A domestic holding for 28 minutes. That's a long time when you're sitting at the side of the road late at night, or you're involved in a domestic issue when you're waiting almost a half hour. Currently we don't have enough officers for every fifth patrol zone that we have in the city. And as you saw from some of the maps on there, our demand for services and our demand for two officer responses is in the core of the city. So what you find is officers having to move towards the center of town, and we don't have very good coverage on the outside of town. Even in the southeast area that Joe mentioned towards the end there, their call for service has gone down, but their response times have increased quite a bit. So we have some areas that don't even have an officer assigned to them. There's several areas on each shift where there's an officer assigned to that particular area. So the intelligence-led policing philosophy and the technology that we have, one of the benefits that we have is it allows our supervisors to better assign officers to areas. We don't have as many officers for each area, so they use that information to determine where the call load can be expected to be. They'll assign them to higher population densities, higher population event densities. You know, your Thursday's on first, you have a lot more people downtown. On the weekends, we have more people downtown, so they'll assign more staff down there. So that really helps our supervisors in assigning staff to where we think they need to be. It doesn't really help for those more minor criminal issues that we have to deal with and people have to wait for a response on. But it does give us the tools to assign people as necessary. One of the benefits of intelligence-led policing and the technology that we have is the officers have so much information available to them. When they show up for a roll call, information is shared, it's debriefed. The officers have the information at their fingertips 24/7. They don't have to wait for a special unit or somebody to come in the next day to give them the information. In the past, before we had this intelligence-led policing initiative, our good officers were already out there talking with people in the community. They were already spending a lot of time data mining our record system and trying to make associations and connections with people involved in crime. But all that information that they gained, it was kept right here in their notebook. They'd take their notes and write it all down here, and it never went to a centralized computer system. It was never analyzed by our intelligence unit, and it was never disseminated to the rest of our staff or made available to our staff. And that's been a great benefit for the technology investment that you folks have made and the intelligence-led policing initiative, is that officers are still collecting this information, but it's being analyzed, it's being disseminated, and it's shared with all the officers, which just makes us that much more successful. The problem I'm having as a patrol captain is, and I'm sure, Council, you've got the same issue, is you have neighborhood members calling and complaining about neighborhood issues, about traffic and things like that. Those are issues that I sometimes have a hard time assigning officers to deal with because they're so busy handling other things. Like I said, we do a really good job handling serious crime and violent crime and those prolific offenders. But when you have neighborhoods calling and complaining about things that aren't as serious, but they need some attention, I have a hard time finding officers that can get over there and spend a considerable amount of time dealing with those issues. And intelligence-led policing and more technology is not going to solve those issues. Those are issues that are always going to be there, and we just need some more resources to deal with those. That's all that I really had. Does anybody have any questions?
Mr. Ruska.
Captain, I appreciate the work that you guys do. We've always tried our best to be real supportive and listen to all the needs and all the things that the good things that are being done in our city. Kind of a hypothetical question. If you had from your perspective and where you are right now, and you had to make your choice between intelligent line policing or 10 officers on the street, which one of those two would you pick?
If we were starting from scratch or starting from right now?
Right now.
Right now, I think we're at a point where with intelligence-led policing that I'd take the 10 officers in a heartbeat.
Okay. And that's because we've got our data. Would that kind of start to put that intelligence-led policing process in mothballs a little bit then if we didn't keep it going? I mean, does it still serve any direct purpose if it's, I know it's data that's been collected over the years, but now will it start to become outdated and almost obsolete then if we don't keep it?
Well, I think we have to maintain that technology and that data because that is a great asset and resource for us in tackling those more violent crimes. I think we're to the point with our technology and data where if there's a trade-off, obviously, and if you're just deciding where you want to put your money, I would personally, the chief might have a different perspective, but you asked me the question, so I'll answer it.
Good call.
Yes, I did.
We could use the resources. We can't forget about the technology. We still have to invest in that. But maybe we can take a little break from the technology to make sure we've got the resources. I don't want to take as big of a break or take a step backwards and it costs even more in the future to get back to where we were, where we need to be.
Right. And I guess maybe as a follow-up question for Tim. Tim, do you know how many cities there are size in the country have intelligent-led policing and the software and everything that we've done to try to be proactive in that? Is that something that's fairly normal? Is that kind of very rare?
We're very unique. And I'll say we're unique because we've taken a fundamentally different approach than many police agencies. And honestly, the reason why we find ourselves in this position is kind of interesting. For many years, I put in budget requests for a crime analyst. Rochester's a pretty nice place to live. And every year, that crime analyst position was struck from the budget. In the meantime, many, many police agencies across the United States were doing crime analysis from a geospatial temporal perspective, traditional crime mapping, and that's where their investment was. well, we had this string of incidents in 2008, 2009, and we said, oh my gosh, what is going on here? We need to do something differently, not just more of the same. In about 2008, there's a textbook written by the PhD at Temple University called Intelligence-Led Policing that talked about this different approach, that if you prioritize your resources on the individuals that are causing the problems rather than the areas that are causing the problems. And so it was a matter of timing, really. There are very few agencies around that use the approach that we do. Now, there was a study conducted by the RAND Corporation that talks about merging these two, and Dr. Ratcliffe also talks about merging these two different approaches. The people-centric approach, on the one hand, that's ISII, along with the where and the when, the traditional crime mapping approach, that's SPSS. You've already made the investment in those two approaches. We just need to maintain our course, maintain the software, and play out that hand. I think we'll find ourselves to be very successful.
Quick follow-up to that. Tim, have we already purchased or acquired all of the software that we're going to need, or is there still more coming forward in future budgets, new elements, new functionality?
Sure. There are other types of business analytics software that we will take a look at down the road. Video analytics is a type of analytic product that's becoming more popular right now. Social media analytics is a huge issue. Our detectives spend a good amount of time trying to keep track of what's being communicated through social media, but they're doing it the old-fashioned way. There's software, there's business analytics software that will do that. All of those products are in the maturation process right now. And as time moves on, I think there are other approaches that we're going to want to look at.
I'm just trying to get a handle on, do we have a good fundamental system in place now that works and we can continue to make work for us? Because we know we're going to have an issue before long with video analytics, with all of the body cam data and having to sit through that.
Exactly.
So I'm just trying to get a sense of if we're pretty okay with what we have or if there are distinct missing elements. I know there's always things we could add, but...
I think right now we have the basic elements that we need. As we add additional video technologies, you're right, Mr. Staver, I think the city of Minneapolis has just recently added some abilities in that area to help sift through the massive amount of data that they're collecting through video.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
I just wondered where the 10 police officers came from. Was it just the number? Or?
That's what
I'm okay,
sure.
I wasn't.
I was thinking 6, 8. I don't know. I mean, you know, because our budget requests, we get that, and in my eyes, we've invested a lot in this intelligent-led policing in lieu of some officers in the past. And now, is it time to consider that in the other direction?
Sure.
That's where I was headed.
The other question is, I assume, you know, it's not like you purchase the software once. We're paying a software license every year on this stuff. Is their initial investment significantly greater than the annual cost of maintaining the software, or is it one of those ones where you pay the same amount every single year?
No, the initial investment is greater, yes.
So we're technology bound now, is kind of what I'm hearing.
Yes. Technology has proven to be very beneficial for us. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that we have leveraged technology so that we have avoided the necessity to hire additional police officers.
Let me correct.
But
we are vendor bound, is what I meant.
Ah, vendor bound.
We picked our vendor. We're going with IBM henceforth.
I would say for the time being,
right.
Yeah.
Mr. Bildebeck.
This is going to come out to be a crappy question. I'm going to ask it anyhow. We invest a lot of money with IBM and their companies. Are they the ones requesting us to go out to these conferences and speak, or is this something the conferences are requesting us because we're trying new technology?
Well, the conferences I presented to New World Systems conferences, other agencies that use the same public safety software suite that we use. It's been very well received. There's been a great amount of interest in what we're doing with other customers. I've also spoken at IBM conferences, and in 2 weeks, this presentation before the National Academy of Sciences is really an interesting opportunity. It came about by virtue of a visit from a gentleman who's working on the National Crime Statistics Exchange Program. He was very impressed with what we are doing here and made that arrangement for the Washington trip.
And just asking, because we invested a lot of money, are we all being their salespeople? Or are we out there actually talking to other law enforcement agencies about what the benefit of this system is? There's a difference in my mind if we're out there being a sales rep for IBM, which I don't want to see us doing.
Well, I'm passionate about what we're doing because I firmly believe that this is the most significant development that I've seen in the last 30 years. And when I have the opportunity to talk to other law enforcement executives, administrators about what we're doing, they're very intrigued, they've been very impressed, and it's caused a lot of interest.
So the short answer is no, we're not out there selling for IBM.
Good.
It's a little tough to present information to a bunch of law enforcement agencies when they ask what tools you're using to accomplish that without mentioning IBM.
And that's fine if you're out there explaining the system and how it's worked for us and what we've done. I just don't want to see us becoming a vendor.
National Academy of Sciences is not interested in who we're using as a vendor. They are interested in what mechanism that we use to...
That I have no issue with us doing that. I just don't want to see us getting to be salespeople for IBM.
All right. Did you have more presenters, or was that...
Well, I just wanted to... Because the questions were asked to Captain Moylan, and I'm sure he felt a little bit put on the spot. What do you want? 10 officers? You want technology? And he was absolutely correct in his answer. You can't separate the two. We have gotten as hard as we have because we leverage everything we can in technology. But if you're asking today, and what our budget reflects, is that we need people on the street, and we need people on the street to address those problems that you've seen as our resources get drawn to the downtown area, because we've been successful, the city has been successful in other areas, creating entertainment districts and creating vitality and entertainment in the downtown area. And it's taking our resources on the periphery of the city and concentrating them downtown. And it's creating significant response time lag. And most of those, we could say, it's a resource issue. We do the best we can. But here's the reality of it. We're not talking about a hypothetical response time. What difference does that really make? Is it a customer satisfaction level? And no, that's not what we're talking about. What you saw in those graphs and what Joe was pointing out to you is that our number of two officer calls, and interpret that to mean multiple officer calls, are increasing. And our ability to get to them is decreasing significantly. The bottom line, people are getting to them. This time last year, I had 12 officers that were in the line of duty and could not work. They were on light duty. All 12 officers at one time. Not 12 officers over the whole summer. That's 12 officers that can't work at one time. Last week, there was 8 officers at one time that we didn't have work. Now there's 7. 4 of them are which are injuries on duty. And when you have that kind of brain, and the common denominator in these, officers are out there trying to control situations without having enough officers present to get that job done. That's how they're getting hurt. They're trying to control somebody one-on-one when there should be 2 officers there. They're trying to control 6 somebodies with only 2 officers there. When that's happening, and those officers getting hurt, our problem gets worse and worse over the summer because the fewer officers, the more officers that we're sending out there without adequate backup. Here's the other side of that equation. When we send officers out there in that situation, the only tool that they have in their toolbox is escalate the use of force that they use to try to control that situation. People are getting hurt. Officers are getting hurt. People are getting hurt. that's the other side of the equation, is that if we've looked across the jurisdictions, across the country, and all these places that have decreased the amount of staffing in their police departments are seeing the same phenomena, and we've seen time and time again with all of these incidents, the common denominator is not enough cops to control the situation. That's an increased use of force, and that means people get hurt. So when you're asking Casey Moylan, what do you want, technology or you want people? It's not a question of, it's not a problem that we can solve with technology. You saw all of the statistical answers there about how we have attacked the problem that we wanted to address 5 years ago and said, we can impact crime in the community, we can prevent crime in the community by focusing on the most prolific offenders, and we've done it. Crime has gone down. But that serious crime that you're seeing represents 2% of what we do for a living. And when there's not enough cops out there, whether it's going to that disturbance call that involved multiple people, or it's that call that's the car on the side of the road that your daughter's been in an accident and it'll be an hour before a cop gets there. That's not acceptable. We're talking about, yeah, we need some more officers out in the street. We don't have any more tools in the toolbox to address that. We can do a lot with the crime and impact and preventative measures and all of this stuff we're doing with other agencies. But when it comes down to it, we're getting people hurt, and we need to address that. I'm trying to make that real blunt for you because I don't want you to have a question, Ed, whether you know the police chief thinks something different than the patrol captain.
I think I asked the question because we've been down this road on intelligent policing and made sizable investments, and we're told that when we do that, it's going to help us to be more efficient and so on. So, you know, I think it's up to the council now to figure out how to get more officers. I mean, I asked that question because I wanted to see how important is it. It's obviously pretty important. And we get requests from every department that needs people, but public safety is a priority, and we've always made it that. And I think by the clarity of what I'm hearing here, it helps me to understand where we're at with it, what we need to do.
I'd add, I mean, when you saw that chart where they said the medical call's been waiting, you can't buy a computer that's going to show up that way. Mm-hmm. So no amount of technology is going to get us out of here. At the same time, you know, I think one of the trends we're seeing is, and we saw 2 weeks ago with the audit, there's departments that are driving the escalating costs of operating the city of Rochester. And so we constantly are going to be hitting this battle again and again. Is we know. I mean, if we could give you 100 more police officers, we'd probably have a lot different outlook on what we needed for police officers. Then we need technology. So it's a balance. And I think we have to figure out where the sweet spot is here. Definitely seeing the data is reassuring that, you know, at a large scale, for strategic decision making, we're seeing the trends in the right direction. I mean, heaven forbid we were having this conversation, all the markers were going the other direction. I think that would be a different discussion. Right now it's how do we stay ahead probably of the growth that we're gonna see and anticipate, you know, move to where the puck's going, not to where the puck is. I think that's an important discussion. So, you know, I appreciate having that conversation.
So Lieutenant, I guess, you know, I've done enough, Captain. I've done enough calls, or enough ride-alongs that I see how spread out you guys get at certain times. And you know, my question is always, when you have something like a domestic, which may not be the, you know, it may become, it may escalate or it may not. How often is there, you know, how often do you respond to those just one squad, and how often do you actually have backup nearby for those types of?
Well, it's not very often that you respond to just one officer to a domestic, but it has a domino effect. Now you're taking an officer who may have been on another call or doing some proactive work, and now they're going to be pulled from that to help you on the domestic. We really try to send two officers to domestics. It would be an anomaly if we didn't. There'd be a lot of stuff going on, more serious stuff going on for us not to get two officers there.
Okay, thank you.
Most of the analysis of those injuries on duty, going through and determining, you know, what exactly, how can we prevent things. It's not that another officer doesn't get there. It's always that an officer doesn't get there in time. That's the one that we've seen where an officer has confronted somebody, been faced with a situation, and tried to control that. Help is on the way. But a minute is a really long time when you're trying to control a situation potentially dangerous as that, and there's an officer in the way. So our records will show, yeah, we do get officers there. injury rate in our IOD reports would show that timing is everything. That's the problem.
So I'm kind of interested from an analyst standpoint. We have the data that tracks our performance relative to the crimes committed, but do we have metrics? Are we tracking internal performance like that, like the amount of officer injuries that are happening relative to the staff on duty and those sorts of things that would help us quantify, you know, here's where we're hitting the limit, here's the ratio we need to maintain going forward?
I think this problem, particularly, I think, starting with last year, we saw a really significant increase in the number of injuries to staff. It was an analysis not of overall call load, seeing how does that relate. That was done later, actually, with what Joe is showing you right there in terms of two officers' calls and multiple response. But what we did see in analyzing the actual injuries is seeing that not all of them, but the great majority could have been avoided by having a sufficient number of officers that called again. So that was really the analysis done last year. We see that repeated and have seen it repeated since. What we're seeing right now is the data to actually back up the what we anecdotally felt or what the feeling was that, yes, we're actually spending less time on the officer-initiated call. We actually have more time and wrapped up on these type of calls that are, you know, complaint that somebody calls in, and we're seeing a significant increase in those calls that are taking multiple officers to handle. So we actually have the data to support what we thought anecdotally was going on, but it's certainly supported in the assessment of each incident as we tracked injuries throughout the past 2 years.
Ms. Means?
I think as elected officials, I bet every one of us has listed public safety as a priority, and we thank you so much for what you do. There's a compelling argument now that you definitely need to have more officers, and I personally would like to support that. The number, I don't know how that would pan out, but it sounds like you need help. I'm probably one of the people that call in for those non-officer initiated when somebody's parked on the street or the bull's in the yard or something of that sort. But that's important to the constituents, too. And if that's an area that's been not neglected, but been put as second or third because of the higher, more significant incidents, well, you know, that would be appropriate. But to the people, they say, well, nobody came out to check on these bowls, for example. Mm-hmm. So thank you again for what you do. Secondly, I wonder, how many officers, do you have any idea, a city of our population size, how do we compare with the amount of officers? I mean, say, for example, if Duluth has 50 and we have 25, or
nationally, I looked at both nationally and in the state of Minnesota. And the answer to your question is we're half. We're 0.5. If you look a little bit beyond that, and I use the numbers that were provided by planning and zoning in 2012 as to what the actual population of Rochester is, that is, we have a population density that's not 110,000, it's 160,000 when, you know, they are like the people that commute, the people that come to visit, and the people that do business in Rochester. And if you look at those numbers of the people that were actually policing, our numbers are one-third of what the national average is. That national average is 2.4 officers per 1,000. And Rochester policing 160,000 people that are actually here is at 0.8 officers per 1,000 people. And I think it's another piece. We've never tried to suggest to you that we should reach or maintain a national average. Rochester is not an average city. But I think it does give you some idea when you look at those numbers and how they interact with that number. We are expecting an awful lot from what is relatively few people in terms of not only the response to the following advisors, but as I said, maintaining a reasonable safety margin when they do.
One thing I will say about intelligent policing, it does concentrate some efforts on the 6% of the prolific offenders, and that has to be real that has to be a real benefit of having that type of technology available to us. But we still need the other people that are checking on the voles. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Ruskin.
I just want to touch base, Roger. If you could, just since we're in this subject, could you give us an update on another sizable investment we made, the recommendation of the community service officer program that we started here a few years ago? And can you give us an update on how that's working? Is it kind of filling some of the gaps? Is it full staffed? Is it healthy? Or where are we at with that?
It does fill the gaps, community service officer form, in order to respond to those low levels, those that didn't take a gun in the background. You need a report file for insurance company. You need to have an incident that's not in progress. You see them frequently at Thursdays on First, the Peace Plaza, no smoking type of issue. They have filled that niche. The benefit is relieving police officers of that call load responsibility, giving it to civilian staff in order to more efficiently address that. Unfortunately, the staff numbers have been reduced. We're currently authorized for two full-time positions, four half-time positions that are authorized but not budgeted. And that the funding for that has actually gone into the police officer side of the equation for all of the reasons I've just given you in terms of what our priorities are in terms of staff. So it is performing a much needed function. It does, it's a little bit of a paradox. What we're asking for is the police officer side to maintain those safety margins. Could we operate more efficiently with a greater number of civilian employees? Yes, absolutely. But we can't afford everything. All the presents out of the tree, I guess we're going to have to prioritize, and I think that's been the focus as we've gone through the budget process. This is what we need most, and we'll be as efficient as we can with that.
Thank you. Mr. Bilbeck, then Mr. Morgan.
Chief, a question for you. I do appreciate what your officers do. I spend a lot of time with them downtown working, and a lot of those officers are on overtime. One of the things, so our officers are required to do a lot of different hour kind of activities. For example, if there are evening shift people, they're called into court. We lose them there. And I'm thinking that we have a fairly senior police department. Most of the police officers have been here for some time, which creates a longevity issue as well as vacation time to be off. How much are we bringing people back on overtime to complete the shifts?
The analysis of those numbers would say, I think in terms of just raw numbers, we're probably spending in the area of $200,000 to $250,000 a year for that particular issue. I think probably more the issue that you're addressing, not a monetary issue, but time available issue. We contract out work for security services for different events. For instance, Rochester Fest that requires police officers to work extra duty capacity. Security for different events, private events that are held in the city, might serve alcohol, need police security for those. The reality is we can't fill those jobs. We can't fill all of those jobs. There's officers that are frankly working too many overtime hours, and they just, we can't fill it on a volunteer basis. Casey can speak to that issue, is that we actually have a system in place now where we used to be able to fill overtime hours on a volunteer basis. That is somebody that wanted to make the extra money to come in to do that. And now they have a system in place that it's no longer volunteer when we can't fill positions, particularly for staff shortages on the street, that they're required to come in. That is a concern for us.
And I would think, realistically, we're probably working short almost every shift.
I think Casey could speak to what they're experiencing actually trying to fill those positions.
Yeah, we're calling people back quite a bit to fill shifts. When you have the injuries that happen on duty, and you know those happen at the last, those happen, and then you don't have anybody to cover them when their shift starts. So you're calling people back to fill those positions. people that may be sick. Routinely, we're allowing people back to fill open positions on the shifts. I can't give you an exact number and percentage right now, but it happens on a routine basis. On Friday and Saturday nights, if our CAT team is not working, we're calling in four people to work the downtown area. There's just that much activity down there that we need four officers, and we can't pull those officers from regular staffing to fill those needs.
Mr. Wojak, and then we'll start to wrap up this part of our discussion. Mr. Wojak, then Ms. Mays. Yes.
Taking all this, I'm going to move all of my criminal activities to off-peak hours for you just to help out a little bit. This is going to come up in the next discussion as well, but one of the things that's perhaps easier for us is if, and maybe you do this internally, but we kind of hear about staff requests, you know, in the year that it's happening or prior to the year that it's happening. And I'm going to be asking department heads to kind of lay out 5 or 10 year roadmaps to what you expect staffing will be. Do you have something like that internally?
Yes, and that information will be given to you at an upcoming meeting, I think, for
17th.
Yeah.
And so you're aware, just briefly, our staffing requests obviously are a result of piling up, so to speak, of what we see. We're not looking for 13 people every year. Matter of fact, we're looking at 2 officers a year after we get to what we believe the staffing level is going to maintain the safety margin. So it's not something we're seeing that exponential, and this is going to be an ongoing issue. But it is, I think, even at that, our staffing level, that 5-year projection is really predicated on past experience. So when we're talking about how fast the city grows and particularly how that increase in population density, to the extent that it's consistent, I think our staffing requests will certainly be in the ballpark. If that's accelerated, I guess there's no guarantees in
mind. No, but I appreciate it. I mean, we pretty much can point out 3 years and have a pretty good idea where our population is just based on what's going on the planning and zoning side. So that would be kind of the goal, is to have more predictable information so we can smooth out the spikes over time.
Right, and we will provide that as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Means.
I'm just kind of curious. There are several officers that are out on special assignments or not on the patrol end of it because of illness or injury. How many of those officers are out because of ergonomic issues? You know, can you raise it, you know, is it a carpal tunnel or is it, you know, back injuries because of the swerving in their seats to enter data on the computer? Do you have that type of injury?
Well, we have looked at the type of injury. And we're doing a couple of things. One is, it's difficult to sort out, for instance, a back injury to say it's ergonomic, because the back injury could well occur when you're actually engaged in a fight with somebody and you're hurt. We have had that instance. We have the other, I guess, longer term chronic injury, because an injury literally that was received 10 years ago in the course of an officer's duty has been aggravated several times since then. And we have an officer currently out with some serious surgery as a result of that situation. We are working with the Mayo Clinic program that addresses the ergonomics and the physical, a lot of the physical action that takes place in terms of being able to effectively do the job that's required of police officers, and a physical training program that makes sure at least we're doing all we can to ensure that they're in good physical condition and prepared in such a way that it'll minimize injuries to the greatest extent. No guarantee, obviously, all bets are off when you have the altercation take place on the streets. But we're seeing certainly a need for that. We don't currently have the situation that you're talking about where it's purely ergonomic. We do need to, I think, acknowledge that anytime your office is located in a car, a squad car, that's probably not the best ergonomic situation for anybody to be in. But we are trying to address that, as I said, with some pre-planning and training with the Mayo Clinic that would hopefully provide at least the best alternatives that we can.
Right. appreciate that. I don't think we could ask much more than cooperating and collaborating with the Mayo on this issue. Thank you.
Okay, what I'd like to do is bring this part of our discussion to a closure. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for the information. I'm guessing some of you will want to stick around for part two. And we'll talk a little bit more about staffing, but good information, and I think it'll be helpful as we get into the budget process. I know Mr. Quenwald, I saw him rapidly recording there, because I'm sure this will play into some of the suggested numbers that he'll bring forward for our consideration. The next part of our discussion, we're talking about staffing, primarily police and fire department. This stems from a request from Mr. Wojak. I think just to kind of set the stage, as has been stated again here today, public safety is a priority for this council, so we continue to pay a lot of attention to it. The numbers that are being requested in terms of dollars for technology and staff are not lost on the council. And as Mr. Campions noted earlier, we need to find that sweet spot where, you know, what is the right number in terms of staffing? And there are a number of things that play into that. And one of the comments that I put out there is to kind of get things going, is this is not an accusatorial sort of thing in any way, shape, or form. We're just wondering, are there different ways of looking at the information, different models we should be considering? What are some other things we could look at just to make sure that we are doing due diligence in terms of evaluating the requests, so that we right-size the services that we provide in the light of public safety. So with that in mind, Mr. Wojak, I'll ask you first if there's other comments you'd like to make to kick it off.
No, you nailed it. It's we have to have these discussions because we all know how important these services are that we're delivering. And part of the reason why I brought this up again, it wasn't actually even originally my idea. I think you brought it up during budgeting, and it wasn't going anywhere, so I wanted to light a fire under it and get the discussion going again. But ballpark, our levy was about $53 million, property tax levy. Last year, total budget, operating budget, $140 million about. If we just take our levy and we throw in baseline inflation, the requested public safety positions, the other high priority positions, and what our shortfall is, and just doing the basic maintenance on the streets, the simple assumptions, and completely ignore other capital needs, transit improvements, library improvements, parks, venues, other services that might be needed. You add those numbers up, and we'd be looking at a 50% property tax increase next year. 50%. We're not going to do a 50% property tax increase, which means we either can ignore the issue, substantially raise taxes, or figure out how we can do things a little bit smarter. And I tend to be very supportive of the public safety request, because I do think that just with our growth, particularly the geographic growth, we are probably falling behind. But I want three things out of this. First, I want just an independent analysis of three key areas: police, fire, and EMT. We handle them in two departments, but really it's three areas to look at, so we get the staffing correct and the funding correct. Secondly, and I touched on this briefly with Chief Peterson, I want to see some long-term planning for these departments, not just these departments, but all departments, really seeing some 5 and 10 year staffing outlook, so we kind of can see what's happening at that levy in the longer term. Handling this 1 year at a time, I don't think is working for us. And third, particularly, and I've hammered on this before, we need less silos between public safety and the things that influence the costs that public safety deal with, in particularly our development patterns and our land use. Most of the response times issues has to do with geography and density, and that's it's something that's going to continue to be an issue for us unless we figure out how to put the services where the people are at a rate that we can afford to pay for them. So those are the three things I'm looking to get out of this, and so long as we get that, I'm a happy camper.
Okay. Mr. Bilbeck.
Just a question. You mentioned EMT, ambulance services. Ambulance is a private enterprise in this city.
Mm-hmm.
So just we can look at police and fire, but I think it's a little difficult to go into the other one without the owner of that group. And go into it. So
and
I,
yeah, I,
you're, I'm not sure where you're going with that.
And
that's
here's
my
thing. There is nothing that is off the table for me. I don't care if we have a private vendor working alongside of us, if they don't want to pick it up, having a public approach to handling this. But I want to do this as efficiently as possible. And, you know, I understand that it's a private service here. And I don't come into this with any preconception of what the right answer is. But I don't think that the way we're currently handling the EMT function is as efficient as it could be.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it could or could not be, but I just wanted to make sure you're aware of that that's a private corporation versus...
And I've heard that they're, you know, they have not been real, you know, warm to some of these discussions in the past, too.
And I have no problem having them, just wanted to make sure you were aware of it.
And sadly, I am. I can't claim ignorance.
One of Mr. Wojcik's comments reminded me of something. You mentioned silos, or that's impact. That reminded me of a note we received from our HR director, at least I received it earlier today, that said, be careful changes you might make in these one or two areas.
Right.
They could have impact in other departments. So again, that silo question, we need to be careful that we don't have the unintended consequence, Mr. Atkins.
Yes, indeed.
You got to pay royalties every time you use it.
but again, that risks making this a much broader discussion.
Yep.
Putting that up. So, Campion.
I would... So when I started and I sat through this, I had the luxury maybe of sitting and watching a budget cycle and not having to say a word, which is, I say a luxury because I think, now I'm beholden a little bit to what I hear from the people around me. And Mr. Bilderbach was there when I held a neighborhood meeting after we had an incident in my neighborhood, and thinking that about 15 people would show up, I had two police officers there, and I'm thinking, oh gosh, I hope I get people because there are two police officers here and I'm going to feel like I'm wasting the city resources. And sure enough, 80 people show up. Because once you post that, when people are scared, when they're concerned, I think we have a responsibility to be there, even if it's, it's 50% emotional, it's 50% practical, I think. So when I look at these budgets, my fear really is it's hard for me to say no to making people feel safe. And I think we all have that same problem. You sit and you go, when you feel scared living in your home, it's a challenge for me. And I'm going to show up and I'm going to talk to you about it. And it's how do we provide that security that people are looking for us to provide in a long-term fashion. And I'm more interested in righting the ship for the long-term because, frankly, I think it was $21 million, I remember, for the new police precinct, and you get 10 police officers or, 5 police officers, whatever it is. Like, those aren't sustainable changes to the system. We're going to have to figure out a way to amortize the changes over a longer period of time so that we can actually sustain what we're looking to do here. So the reason I mentioned consultant isn't to throw any ideology under the bus. It's because, frankly, we seem to be basically pegged for both police and fire in terms of, what providing just the service we have. So how do we bring another set of resources in to say, man, we just need to plot a course to get out of the, and I'm going to use the word morass, but how do we get out of the situation where, frankly, I know it doesn't put you guys in a good position either. Come back and ask us for a $20 million upgrade or a $10 million change to your operating budget. So I think I'm looking at how do we take these costs and array them out over a longer period of time, knowing where the puck is headed so that we're going to meet up at some point in the future and, hopefully have a sustainable system instead of, the ups and downs that come with how we're doing it today.
I think a key question that we're going to try to answer today, though, is do we feel that there's a need for this outside independent view, or are we saying that we largely know the answers, absent maybe some analysis that Mr. Wojcik talked about? We know the problem. We just haven't been able to step up provide a solution. So that's a question for me.
I think Mr. Wojcik's right, and Mr. Campion. We're all from the same boat. We all think very highly of our public services, but we've seen what they've done too. We've watched the fact that we went from 4-person engines in the fire department to 3 so we can get another engine out and stretch it. We've watched the police department. We've heard from the chief talk about the downtown entertainment area, that he liked it because the consolidation of his officers made response time quicker to take care of those issues. And unfortunately, an unintended consequence, Mr. Atkins, shows us that now we have the issues of response times on our side. We've looked at different things with the fire department is moving the stations to, so we can try to make sure that we maintain that 4-minute response time from when they get the call. That's all going to continue to get pressured and stressed. We can, if we add more officers, which we all agree that we need to do, a couple months ago we just heard about the issues of space. So there again, we're setting ourselves up when we do these things for those unintended consequences that we need to take care of. That. I think our people have done a pretty good job of bringing up new ideas and using new thoughts. Going out looking at for other groups to help us, I don't think is a bad deal. I just have a real lot of questions. If we do that, what are the metrics? How are we going to measure? What are we trying to measure? What are we hoping to get out of that? So there's a lot of questions that I have if we go outside to bring somebody else in. But again, I'm open to ideas. We've seen what our groups have done. They've done a lot of cutting. They've done a lot of sacrificing. And now trying to figure out, is that the correct way to do it or not? I have no problem with that.
So we're done.
And I mean, you were here when we requested quite a bit of data last year, and just it didn't come to fruition. And I've been out there trying to just find some independent resources to look at. And I think I sent you one thing that had an article from an independent peer-reviewed journal on staffing. And what they found in the Toronto area is, how often was the they had a sample size of like 200,000. They were looking for how often the fire first response was critical to the health outcome. And they found in their study about 1.7% of the time was when that came up. Well, we all understand how important that is, but if 10% of our community can't get the basic services anyways, it's I think there's an allocation of resources issue that comes into play right there. And and I also sent you that chart that's showed that change in what the fire department calls volume has been between 1980. We had about 3 million calls for fire and about 5 million calls for medical calls. Now since then the fires are about cut in half, but the medical calls have gone from 5 million to 20 million. EMS is really the key thing here, and I don't want to be forcing a square peg in a round hole, and that's mitigated by the fact that a lot of our firefighters are EMTs. But I don't know if the current way that we're approaching the problem is appropriate.
I have no problem looking, but I had different ideas, again, as I said. But I think, again, one of the things we need to all understand and be very appreciative of is what happened in Rochester with Dr. Waite, and the fact the fire department, the police department, and the AEDs, our police and fire are the highest saves in the country, and they have been for many, many years. So changing what equipment was procured in the squad cars as well as the fire trucks have made our community a much safer community overall. Again, I'm not opposed to looking, but I think we also need to realize and look at the people that we put in charge to do these jobs and the different things they've come up with and done. Chief Peterson with the CAT team and the street crime team, different perspective from what we used to use, but have been very effective. Again, the 3 firefighters, rig versus 4, has given us an extra rig. We're going to have growing pains, and we need to look, be open and willing to look at what's out there. But I think we also need to appreciate from some of the things that have happened from the groups that we have serving us.
Just out of curiosity, could you repeat a couple of the numbers? You talked about 20 million calls. That seems like an awfully high number.
Well, this it's for U.S. Fire Department, so it's this was the.
Oh, so this wasn't this, Rochester.
We have not had 20 million fire calls in Rochester, so that's a good thing. That's actually from the National Fire Protection Association. They track that on an annual basis.
Okay, all right.
So, and we would expect a similar trend here, if not more.
Right. What I'd like to do is perhaps invite the respective chiefs to offer some comments as part of the discussion, if that's okay. And as we're trying to
run and administration as well. I want to see where they're coming from.
So, which one wants to
start? You might as well have them both come up because the fact that both be asked the same types of questions. So might as well have them both here.
And I guess that would be my first question is, does this seem like a reasonable course of action to want to use some sort of outside resource to just help us get our minds around this a little bit better?
Well, I think, as I should mention, we've approached this from a standpoint of leveraging as many of our resources to get the best outcome that we can. And I would think if we had an outside consultant come in, that hopefully they would verify that. But the worst case scenario is that they wouldn't, and we have some better ideas on the table, that there may be a different way to approach some of these issues. And I know internally we've discussed response policies, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where a lot of this is centered, is actually response policies as opposed to maybe just staffing equations. Staffing equations don't necessarily work out too well.
No, and in general, I try to separate those two as well, because really I think the staffing requests that are on the table are minimal relative to what our real needs are. This is more about some of the long-term stuff and the policies and practices.
And I think as we've had those discussions about, you know, response policy in terms of not only priority, but what do we respond to, what don't we, what's important to the community, I think that if in fact we're making the best decisions, and hopefully a study would verify that, if there's a way for us to improve, I think, you know, obviously we have to be open to that as well. So I'm absolutely not opposed to a study from the standpoint of, are we actually, for our community, employing best practices in terms of how we can best utilize our resources. I'm hopeful that a study would tell you, yeah, we already are. But as I said, I think the worst case scenario would be, no, there's actually ways that we can get better, and that's not a bad outcome either. So.
Yeah, I guess I would echo some most of that. I don't see that it would do any harm. I think we have a lot of the data and kind of know a general direction, but like Chief Peterson, if there's a better way to a better process, but we should certainly be open to looking at it. I think much of what you will find is that it would verify some of the best practices and some of the administrative changes we have made to increase service in the face of demand. Our numbers are very similar to the police department. If you look at firefighters per 1,000, we're about half based on population. Factor in the Mayo Clinic daytime population, and that ratio drops. And we're not suggesting that we get to the national average of 1.6 per 1,000. We're about 0.8. We know statistically, looking at the comprehensive plan and going forward where we're going with population growth, that we need about 1.64 firefighters a year just to stay even with call demand. Looking at a statistical extrapolation, you know, I can tell you where I think the next two stations should go. Generally, but again, because you know we're not looking at crime; we're looking at demand and coverage for services, and we map out profiles all the time with our mapping folks and planning, and we can project all of those things. So I think we'd have a wealth of data for a consultant to maybe take an independent look at it, but I don't know that we'd see great revelations.
I think Mr. Wojcik's comment is important, that this focuses more on a long-term strategy. Sure. It'd be unrealistic to think that we would do anything in time for this budget, for example. Mr. Campion.
So I understand now. I'm trying to get my head wrapped around what we have and what we don't have. So I'm hearing from both of you that you have the information you feel like is driving the future of the growth of the departments, both of them, correct? So I guess what I'd look to administration and say, is this something where we can already draw out a 15-year plan for these two departments, know about what it should cost to grow them at the rate of the city, and then lay that out? Because ultimately what I think I'm a little bit concerned about is getting back something like, here's a $20 million request for a new police precinct, which maybe we need. You know, maybe that's what we need. But then not hearing necessarily the follow-on that says, here's how the police department's going to grow for 15 years, and you can see exactly where we need it is year, and it, you had some of this. But that kind of, how do we get this information for these year-by-year growths back to this process of budgeting because then we can tell, you know, if you have a drop-dead date of 2020 to have this new precinct in, well, I can tell Public Works that we're going to have to wait to do some seal coating of some roads to figure out how to pay for your police station. And I can go back to my constituents and I can explain that. But just showing up every year and being surprised, we need a new police precinct, I mean, that you know that won't fly. So it's how do we, frankly, I want to equip you to do your jobs as best as we can. How do we build a plan that lets us forecast that so we can have the money available when the time comes?
And staffing, just in public safety, you know, we don't operate in isolation of other departments. Someone's got to change the oil in the squad cars and the fire engines and run the budgets, hire the people, on and on and on.
I respect that, and yet I'll tell you, like, there are two. I hear more about public safety than I hear about any other facet of our city, except for maybe streetlights. Get a lot on that lately, but I think that it's one of those things where if you're going to be the driver of the budget, and frankly, you can look at almost every budget analysis we do. Your two departments drive the budget. We have to figure out how to project your costs. So the rest of what we do here is, you know, projecting costs is not really entirely useful. If you're market movers, we can't predict you. We can't really predict much about the city budget. So I guess what I'm looking at is a cohesive unit between public safety and administration. What can we do to lay out a path here? And if there's not people to do it, I'm open to getting a consultant just to support you guys in how we draw out this plan. But if there is, then let's take a look at what we can do, because I completely agree. This is not a sustainable, you know, having these ups and downs isn't going to be sustainable.
I think the five-year plan that we're going to talk about next week, I think that's the first time we've ever done that. That in itself is going to be a pretty interesting discussion. Ms. Means, you had a question?
I actually believe that a consultant would be beneficial over a very long period of time, and not immediate, but something that I think would be a benefit to us to help us to identify some statistically proven options and some best practices. But more broadly than that, we can't do it for just two. We have to do it for all the departments, as you referenced earlier, from a note from our human resources director, that what they need and how it would affect, you know, someone in maintenance. Or so there are other factors to consider, just than the two most highly visible safety advocates for city administration.
At this point in the discussion, I'd like to be interested in the city administration point of view on this and maybe where you see this going.
Well, my view of the situation is that it really comes down to money. And I haven't seen in the councils that I've worked with a tendency to levy the money that would be needed to take care of these needs. If you hire a consultant, they're going to tell you you need more people. And you don't even in every department, basically. I don't know if they're going to be much aid to you in determining how much you should levy for 2016 and beyond. And, of course, in some years, you haven't had the ability to levy because of levy limits, and they may come back. In some years, we've had frozen levies, so you haven't been able to do perhaps what is needed. I understand what public safety be a priority, but I don't think that you would be able to keep the other organizations just as it is right now. You'll have a hard time accommodating the request from police and fire if that's all you do for the next few years. You still won't get to that point because I don't think politically you can levy the money that would be necessary to accommodate it. So where does that leave you? I'm not sure. We probably go along some of that as we have in the past and do the best that you can with the available resources. Now, you're going to have this five-year staffing plan, which is good that the departments are putting this together. But economically, and they're trying to do the best they can to parcel that out. Economically, again, I don't believe that the public would put up with the... They may want more public safety, but they don't want any more taxes. And that's what it comes down to. And I think you as city council are going to have a hard time increasing the levy to just take care of the demands that these two entities put before you in 2016. you're going to need a tremendous property tax increase just to take care of their staffing request for 16, let alone all those years beyond that. Then you mentioned a police precinct, another fire station, all the people that come along with that. I mean, you have some significant cost in the future if you're going to accommodate that. I guess I don't think that a consultant will provide any great help for you, and because they're going to get, again, like I said, they're going to indicate we need more staff. But if you do a consultant, I think you should have some outside view of all of the other departments also, because you have to have an organization that provides services to all the public, and some of those other services are also essential, perhaps in fighting or helping to offset the need for law enforcement in some cases. I know Roger's made the case before that some park and recreation activities are beneficial for the fact that if you have activities for people, that they probably has less need for enforcement down the road. So that you have to have some balancing act with all those other departments at the same time. You can't just rely on taking care of just police and fire.
Gary, you sent out a note about one of the firms that kind of does this. And reading through some of their stuff, I guess I wouldn't necessarily jump to that they're going to come up with that same conclusion. We might be a bit stretched that there are going to be some departments that certainly comes out in. But one thing that's unique in terms of the public safety area is I want particular that insight into how we're responding to the medical calls. That's something that is one thing very specific that I'm looking for, because as I said from the start, I'm not an expert on public safety, and that's why I want to get an independent voice who is an expert and dealt with, because it's handled differently all over the country. And the other thing, you know, quite frankly, I'll be honest and say part of getting an independent voice here is kind of a little bit of covering my butt, too. I mean, if we're going to be putting some substantial property tax increases out there in the future, I'd kind of like to know that we did due diligence and saw that this is what is absolutely necessary to deliver the services.
I understand that point.
Mr. Mayor?
Well, I'm going to say this, and I don't think anybody is questioning the credibility of these two departments, but to me, we have the experts right here. They've been invited to speak at other places around the country. I don't think the outsiders would understand our community and its future growth one bit better than these guys do right now. So to me, to go outside is a waste of time and money.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, without having dug into this in depth, I think that's my gut feeling is that it's, you know, more a, we have to have the will to spend the money required to address the needs. I think we have a reasonable idea of, you know, what the need is, and I think with the five-year study, you know, projection, I think that'll be another tool.
Mr. Quindle.
And I guess hopefully today I'd like to leave with some idea of, if I understand you're saying police and fire is a priority, and we have a request for about 50 positions for 2016, and obviously both you're going to have to cut that down and I'm going to have to make some recommendation to cut that down. And I would like to know if your priority is in police and fire is strong enough that that's where we only look for any additional positions in 16. That would be very helpful for me in making recommendations to you. And you maybe don't want to do that at this point in time, but in 7 weeks you need to adopt a 2016 maximum property tax levy. And I'm putting together some information on just what increase would take to stay level with where we are right now. And I'd like to know, you know, what their appetite is to add. And if your appetite is just going to be focused on public safety in 2016, that would make my job a lot easier in making recommendations to you. Because I'm not going to recommend 50 positions. I mean, I'm going to try. I'm just not going to recommend 50 positions. That's just not realistic.
Got nothing to say after that.
Mr. Bilderback. I still have a little bit of a. I agree with Mr. Wojcik and the fact that he has concerns about how EMS is interacting with our public safety people. And I'm just thinking maybe it would be a good thing to be able to invite EMS or get some of the questions or concerns that Mr. Wojcik has so we can get it to those people and also get the feedback from our public safety people to see what's happening or where we can start thinking about you obviously, I would think, between the chiefs, they have some thoughts on what could go better or what could work a little better with our ambulance. And I think if there's a hiccup there, and listening to Mr. Wojak and his concerns, I think it would be wrong of us to drop it at this point. I think we need to get those groups together, get those questions together, and see what we can do with our chiefs and maybe one or two of us on the side working with those groups to see what the issues are, what we can figure out. I don't know if I want to bring it back to a council of the whole until we have the opportunity to kind of look at it. But I do believe with the insight of the chiefs and maybe some of the concerns that Mr. Wojak has and maybe other council members, we can gather those and have those addressed.
Yeah, and I guess maybe as an aside before we get to the big decision, based on Ardell's comments about the, I have this question of, is the current process of having fire response for these medical calls the best way to do it? And you've stated, your opinion that, yes, it's absolutely the way of the future. And I think that we need more information, but I do want to go around and say if you're, yes, let's keep doing it that way. No, let's not do it that way, or should we get some more information? I just want to see where everybody's at.
What question?
Should the current process of having fire serve the as priority response for the EMS calls?
Well, I think Mark's got a good point here. I think we should see if we can get maybe EMS here and maybe get the three of them at the table and talk about it.
Yeah, I do think that because right now we do have such a high save rate. Now, I'm not saying I'm agreeing with you, Mike, but I think maybe looking at some of the issues and concerns might make that a better process. And at that point, that would be fine. But right now, the way it's set up with our ambulance services in the garage, if they bring in extra crews, they're usually running transfers between the hospitals. So right now, asking fire not to respond to medicals, I think, put our citizens in more danger, in jeopardy, because now many times fire is the first one on scene. And so I think until if there's questions right. and concerns, I have no problem with looking at those and working on addressing them. But I wouldn't recommend any change right now until those things are looked at and addressed, and we have some recent good ways to flesh it out, because I do believe it's important for our citizens to be taken care of the best way possible, and our fire is a number of the times the first responder or the first one on scene. When I do employee orientations, I always make the joke about the fact that in Rochester, the fire responds, the police responds, and the ambulance parks a block and a half away to get to it because we have all these emergency groups there. But in reality, that's true. Our fire and police are a vast majority of the time ahead of the ambulances, wherever they're coming from.
Right.
So until we figure that out, I wouldn't want to change.
Well, and I think that's part of why looking if an ambulance was physically located in the same spot as the fire department, the response would probably be equivalent, but I'm with you on I want more information as well.
Yeah.
Assume you want more information.
I feel like we're kind of picking between two propositions we don't know enough about. So,
Chief Martin, you had a comment?
Well, I just wanted to point out that if an ambulance is in a fire station, which is a common model around the country, there are some public private partnerships, but regardless, that doesn't necessarily mean that fire would not go on a given medical. There's standards based on good patient outcomes. For example, a minimum standard for a cardiac arrest is 2 BLS, in other words, 2 EMTs and 2 paramedics on scene. That's a minimum standard that the American Heart Association has set, NFPA 1710 also, I believe. And again, that's a minimum. It's about time and resources and how your system is structured. We lead the nation with King County, which is Metro Seattle and Seattle, in survival rates, about a 50% outcome according to Dr. White's statistics. Research is indicating what Chief Peterson and I are seeing. The time from the 911 call to a shock being administered is lengthened by about a minute and a half since 08 up till about 2012. this last study I'm looking at. Granted, one of the study has a small sample, but it is an indicator of a trend, I believe. And in his research, Dr. White's research indicates that time is critical. As soon as you get there and deliver a shock on any given day, it might be a squad car, could be Gold Cross ambulance because they're a block away when it comes in. It could be us. But again, it's a tiered system, and again, those standards are that you get BLS on scene first in this model, because people don't die in the first 5 minutes because they need an IV. They die because their heart isn't beating, or they can't breathe, or have a heart attack, or they're bleeding to death, and that's what BLS is designed to support, and that's why, how you have a successful outcome. So,
Okay, Mr. Wojcik. And I absolutely agree and understand with what you're saying. There are certain calls that the fire department's always going to be out on, and that's part of the reason why I was interested in, you know, made that request last year for the data. I'm going to read you one paragraph here from this from the peer-reviewed article. Firefighter first response was warranted in 3,067, or 1.4% of the 220,358 incidents defined as having at least one of the study's FFR trigger criteria, CPR, defibrillation, AED analysis, or a patient rated by the treating paramedics as requiring resuscitation. And that's the key thing here is that they found, you know, a huge sample here, 1.4%. And that's, you know, if how much do we save by having, you know, an ambulance with two people staffing it responding to the other 98%?
Well, there's a couple of things that would, again, we'd have to look at. I mean, some systems use a tiered response. They triage the calls at the point of 911. And number two, that's a retrospective study after the fact when you know what the outcome was. Well, we, as Chief Peterson and I well know, that what's reported on a 911 call isn't always the situation when you get there.
Just so I can summarize where we're at so far, here's what I'm hearing. We agree that public safety is a priority, subject to certain financial realities. We're open to new ideas, looking at new ways of doing things. We agree we need more information, though. I think where we're stuck is, do we have the resources? Can we put together a group and gather that information ourselves, or do we really need an external consultant? I'm hearing from the mayor and Mr. Quenville that a consultant might not tell you anything necessarily new. We're going to go down the line here, Mr. Bildebeck, and then Mr. Campy, and then Mr. Quenville.
Well, what I was going to suggest is I'd be more than willing to be on a group with the chief and look at the questions that Mr. Wojcik has, if he'd be interested to be there. That way we can sit down with, because it seems like most of his questions have to do with EMS at this point. Take a look at those, bring in the Mayo representatives from the ambulance service, discuss some of the questions, concerns, come up with something, then come back here, then make a decision whether you need to go to the consultants or not. But it seems that most of the questions, again, are focused on EMS and fire, and I'd be more than willing to volunteer to work on that group and try to bring those questions and concerns together. Then I'd be more comfortable with coming up with whether we need a consultant or not. Mr. Campion.
I'm going to pass.
I'd just like to say, I'm going to retract my earlier request of you that I leave here today with some idea of what you might want. I guess you've given me the, I know that you have public safety as your priority. I do have a responsibility as city administrator to make recommendations to you on what I see as the needs for the organization. And I will do that, and you will be free to accept, reject, or amend. And so I don't need anything more from you other than I understand what your needs are, and I'll try to make recommendations that fit into some political reality for an increase in property taxes.
I mean, I'm glad you said that, because that was kind of where I'm going. Like, we need an objective analysis. The problem is when I have constituents beating down my door every single day talking about feeling safe, like, there's one priority in my mind. And so I need an objective analysis, someone that's here to run, you know, to tell us the health of an organization that's going to take a hopefully a broader perspective of the needs of the city. And I'll need to weigh that accurately when we get into discussions, because if you're, you can get too myopic, I think, and think we can solve this just with all more police or all more fire or another fire station. But a lot of times it's the unit has to be working as a whole, pulling the entire cart in the same direction. Otherwise, other parts start to fall off that you weren't even expecting. So
what about Mr. Vilbeck's idea of, you know, a council member or two participating and pulling together some key representatives from three constituent areas, fire, police, and emergency services, and at least try to sift through, work through some of the questions that have been raised. I have some that I'd written down. Mr. Wojcik provided some, and at least give us a bit more clarity on what we think some of the issues are, Mr. Wojcik.
I'm okay with those suggestions as well. I'd be happy to sit in on that. I don't know if I'm the best person to do it. Frankly, I'd look at you and say, what do you think? So, you know, I kind of get that. I do want to hit on, we talked a little bit about the first two, but I do want to talk about the less silos things too. We're hearing about the critical importance of these response times again. And then when we get some of the development proposals, changes that come in, you get to the public safety lines for comment, and there's nothing there, even though we're developing low density in an area that's going to expand response times for a generation. Those silos have got to go away. I mean, you saw a note from one of our planning commissioners who's been asking staff to provide this information with applications because they feel it's a public facility that must be adequate, and they're not even getting them in the reports right now. Those silos have got to go away.
Comment I would have on that, I don't know if that the police and fire people that run that would be the entities that should determine the development pattern for their community. I think that's good beyond their responsibilities. They would react to, I suppose, whatever the development pattern is that you and the governing body and the development community would arrive at. But I don't think they should drive changes.
Then why do we give them why do they comment on it?
Well, they could comment on it, but I mean, you bring up that change in development patterns all the time, which
yes.
I understand.
Yes.
But then you have to get some traction among your colleagues here on the same thing, and traction in the development community, and you haven't gotten that. And I don't think that they necessarily would be the ones that would drive that traction.
Have I not
gotten that? I think what Mr. Wojcik's asking, what the comment was from the person, was they'd like to know, for example, in fire, if that's within a 4-minute response time. And I think that's what something simply that they're just looking to see is, on a normal basis, if that was the only, if that unit was in the station, would it be able to make it in 4 minutes or less? I think that's what the comment was, and I think that's what he's looking for. I don't think that's driving the development. I just think that it's just saying.
Well, I think what Michael's getting at is the density and the sprawl drives costs up of service, which I understand.
I'm looking at to see, can they make that response time? Does that fit in their circle plot of if that 4-minute response call for when they get to call at the station? That's what I guess I took it as was.
Yeah.
So there's coverage and volume, and we cover most of the city in a 4-minute profile, but that's also not realistic at certain times of the day.
And that's understood. But on a basis of we've got the units in the station, could they make that 90 minutes, or 4 minutes or 90 minutes, or better, 4 minutes or less?
And I think we have to be careful because there's multiple factors here. I remember the one map that was showing, you know, the call for service. Based on that colored map, I would say urban cores are a bad thing because that's where all the calls are.
For all those that are in the
corner. And I'm being facetious.
Yeah, no,
you know, and following up on this, because Michael and I have a lot of back and forth on this matter of what he wants and what I might follow through on. And so, are you saying then if you got that information, and so if Greg gets a referral and a development, he indicates what sort of the response time is, that's decreasing the silo?
Yeah.
Is that what you expect from them?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely critically important. So this goes to, it drives our costs on everything else. So.
And if you and the rest of the council want that information from police and fire?
It was requested by planning for planning and zoning when they review process. It was not requested by us per se.
Right.
It was requested by another committee.
Yeah, well, I'd like to know if that's what you want.
If I may, I think there's aspects of a lot of projects that come through that would be helpful to understanding and starting to unfurl some of these problems we have. You know, one is certainly the response time of police and fire, and then we also talk about there's projects where they're going to turn back a road after the development, and we oftentimes ask, you know, what's the cumulative cost of this roadway once we take ownership? But those sort of things are where we start being able to bake into the development plans, and we're on the tip of the spear up here planning the development that's going to be, you know, where people are going to be living in for 50 years. If we don't make the right decisions at the tip of the spear, you know, we can't be complaining at the other end when, you know, things aren't coming out the way we're planning. So it's not, I don't know if we want to use the overload term silos and all that, but for me it's a, you know, if we're not getting the information, I think you can claim ignorance at the council meeting and say, well, you know, I don't know, it's great, we're getting another road, you know, I feel like I can make this connection. You don't know this road decreases response time but increases our public works liability by $20,000 a year. Like, those sorts of things have to start being a factor in driving the development patterns we're going to follow as a community. Otherwise, we'll never work ourselves out of these problems. Like, these problems are systemic. Like, this is a systemic problem. We have to change the trajectory. You can't solve that by changing the end result.
And I'm not arguing against it. I just want to say Michael and I get them back and forth a bunch with the fact that he wants something, or he says he wants something. And if you don't say something back, then Michael and I getting back and forth whether or not I'm carrying through on the consensus of the council. So I'm trying to make sure that you are in agreement with what Michael's saying, so I can kind of avoid some of that back and forth that he and I get involved in from time to time.
Well, I think in the past you've sent out questionnaires to us about if we support it or not, and you usually get either you do or you don't. So I think that's a fair way to do it. That's what we've been doing.
He usually gets about three of them back and bunch of people that didn't
But I
respond.
Think this committee meeting is the ones that we get most of back and forth on.
Well, one other thing, too, since the city attorney is no longer here, I believe that leaves me as the city attorney, so...
I don't think so.
you know, we do, there is direction that we, no development is allowed in the city of Rochester unless you have adequate public facilities. And, you know, it becomes a question, is this a public facility? You know, there are a lot of cities that view fire coverage as being an adequate public facility, and that speaks to some language that's already in place, so we either decide if it's important or if it's not.
And I understand, Michael, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with everything you might ask, but if the rest of the council doesn't necessarily, as a consensus, say they agree, then I don't view that as direction.
So the specific question is whether we would be asking the fire department to include, as part of their comments and for development proposals, whether the project is or is not within the 4-minute
response. Yeah, and a referral agency, yeah. I suppose, some sort of response time question.
Well, I would say two things. I mean, it's one is within that 4-minute range, or where does it fall approximately? But I think the other one is this likely to negatively affect response times in other areas in the future? And I think those are both key, and they have the expertise to answer both.
You know, I guess we could ask for more information, but I suspect they'll look at the map, such as they provided, and say, well, it's in this geographic region, response times there are roughly 3.6 or 5.2 or whatever, and say, yay or nay. Vance, question?
That's a volume comment.
Yeah, when we do code review, it's based on what City Council has adopted for code. So what you're asking us or my staff to do is make a referral, not on anything that's said. City Council has not made any type of statutory or local authority or local ordinance that says you shall respond, you shall be within X amount of time. So I'm not sure what the referral is going to do for other than put extra pressure on my staff to try to go over and evaluate that. We evaluate the code requirements for water flow, street access, building design, and stuff like that. But to tell you it's outside the 4-minute response zone that's currently available, I'm not sure what that's going to do to you, because there's no legal ramification to that. There is no code thing that says you may have to be within 4 minutes of a fire station in the city of Rochester, unless City Council wants to adopt an ordinance to do that.
So you couldn't necessarily use that as a finding to support or deny a project?
Correct. I mean, we'll put the information there. If that's what City Council asks us to do, we'll do that. But I'm not sure what that will
I'm
be
looking for creative help from these agencies, not fight. Because what I'm trying to do is put the information that you're telling us. I mean, what I hear is we grow Northwest, response times get bigger. So when somebody comes and suggests 500 units of residential housing on the periphery of Rochester, is that a positive or a negative from the police department, fire department? Is that, that doesn't seem like it's too much to ask.
He's saying well, needs an ordinance to base it on.
I can put the information there. It's not sure. There's no enforceable capability to it.
I don't even care about response time. Let's take it back from response time. I'm asking a leadership question about, is this the direction, you know, does this, well, maybe,
well,
it seems like
one,
you get
one
what
of
I'm
the
asking.
Things we fired did on the last comprehensive plan, we submitted comments to Mitzi Baker and talked to the consultant that was doing the comp plan to try to have fire medical needs included as a criteria in the comp plan, because as I understand it, the comp plan does have some enforcement, if you will, with council. It's not a code thing, but and we've never done that before, so
that's
that was
true.
One angle I was looking at for that.
Okay. I would say in the comp plan, they're also costing out what different facilities are going to cost, and different, you know, if you develop in this area, how much does it cost versus... Mm-hmm. Let's say infill development. So I think that'll
that would satisfy what I was looking for.
That'll be a good step. Yeah. On this particular issue, I don't know what it's going to get you from another practical reason, which is you change your station locations and you change, for fire at least, not for police. You change your station locations and you've changed the whole picture. We've changed the station locations now on three of our four that we had formerly.
Yeah.
And we did so because we had a prior study that said right now with your coverage lack, you'll need 8 fire stations soon. And so we had a concerted effort with the chief and others in the department to reposition our stations, and we provided good coverage by repositioning our stations instead of building 8. So and back in that day, you would have been saying every development that occurred for about 30 years would have been outside of response time, but you also needed somewhere to grow. I mean, the city doubled in size back in the era from 82 to now. You also need places to go. So, you know, you'd also have to factor in then, where are you going to put your next fire station? Will it be in an area where you had 2 beds? I don't know what it gets you. I do think that issue that Michael's bringing up is a legitimate one to bring up in the comp plan. I mean, that all factors into where you put your investments. Do you grow in the Northwest Territory, or do you grow in other areas of the community? And I think that'll actually be an interesting issue that'll come out of the comp plan.
The Northwest Territory.
All right.
Lois and Clark.
As long as we get to the right answer, you know, where we're not building things that we can't afford anymore, in the long run, I'll be happy if we can provide the services. In the shorter run, but you have to remember, is when things go to planning and zoning, they're doing a lot of. It's usually there for a reason. It's not a countertop approval, and there's and they're comparing against the comp plan, which you know does speak to adequate public facilities. So I think. There is an opportunity there to at least weigh that information in most of the things they're considering.
I would say, and also on just a tidbit, but in the cities where they use it, in these other states where they use adequate public facilities, they also are allowed under state law to do exactions for police stations, fire stations, parks and recs. In Minnesota, you can only do it for park and recs. So actually, in places where they use that same definition we use, which we were one of the first in Minnesota, mm-hmm. I believe, to use, Minnesota law isn't as broad, so you can't factor in getting money out of new developments to pay for those things like you can in some of the other states that actually are more aggressive on what they call community exactions to pay for new development.
Okay. Well, I'm looking to start wrapping this up, and it seems like we've got a couple questions on the table. One is this commentary from the fire department. Maybe there's a sentiment toward making sure that the tenant within the comp plan might be more amenable. And then that first question of, do we want to do an internal group to at least assimilate some of the information needed, and then we can make a more informed decision on whether we need a consultant or not. Mr. Rusk, do you have a comment?
I'd like to volunteer to help Councilmember Bilderback pull together something internally if he needs some additional members. In particular, I think one thing we could look at is making sure we understand arguments that are coming forward for the comp plan, so when we get back in the comp plan cycle, we can supplement it with some clear understanding of what our chiefs are telling us related to the services.
Okay. Anyone else in agreement with that as far as the direction?
Yep.
And then you hold off any decision on any review until after that gets done?
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right.
Okay.
So you get the luxury of writing up the minutes.
And so then Mark and Nick will lead that discussion.
What I'm hearing.
With I heard police, fire, and Gold Cross.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Good. Very good discussion. Anything else for this afternoon?
Maybe the request for Gary then, but I sent out a note about MnDOT opening up. They have some funding available. It's kind of the economic development funding that last time we were successful in getting Elk Run done. I'd be interested in knowing what the criteria is for the out-state funds as part of that MnDOT bonding, those bonding dollars that are out there, the $30 million for economic development. And if we could possibly do a cluster park and ride transit-oriented development and compete for the funds for that, or whether it has to be strictly...
Like TED funds?
I think it is TED funds, but it's split between... I think it's split between MnDOT and DEED this time, and there are some set aside for outstate Minnesota, and my assumption is that Rochester will score exceedingly well on whatever the criteria is, but this might be an opportunity to actually get a, one of the desperately needed structured park and rides, either south or north or something. And Richard's got something on
that. Well, it's $30 million, and $28 million is in MnDOT trunk highway funds, and $2 million is for DEED general obligation bond money.
And
so you're really going to compete for the $2 million.
But if there was special does that not include the connections to the highway?
It just says MnDOT trunk highway funds. So
65th Street qualifies. Then.
An interchange, a road project of some type would qualify.
Yeah, I'd just be interested in some feedback. I know you work a lot with the coalition and or from Richard as well, but I'm interested in... we can pursue some of those dollars.
I'll talk to Richard. We'll get in and see what we can find out.
All right. Anything else? Mr. Ruskin.
I just wanted to kind of throw out for food for thought about the chateau. The sale isn't complete yet. We've talked about forming a committee and getting people together, a leadership group, and I just think it's up to the council to think a little bit about really making it, getting some clear direction out here, having some discussion maybe the composition has been different people, different representations that's been thrown out there, but I think it's up to us to think maybe a little bit about timelines on it, updates. If we have I think it should be a task force, not a committee. I think there should be a certain task that they understand what they're doing, timeline with an idea of an outcome, an end date, and some updates to us on the kind of the direction that the group's headed. With that, I think the charge, the major focus, priority should be like, really important part of this is this, is it up to the council feels strong that this should be sustainable to the point where no tax dollars are going to be used to run this facility, or is it something that the city's going to put under their umbrella and see how it goes and put dollars to it? I mean, I just think it's important for us to get those things talked out and a good direction to this group so that when they go to get together, they understand what it is that they're working on, what are we looking for from them, and how do we want to see this thing operated? I've heard some discussion that if the city ran a certain department ran it, that we would take up to 21 employees. I mean, how would we take that on, and how would we be able to run that under our umbrella of the tax base? It wouldn't happen. So we don't want any misunderstandings or misdirection from that group moving forward. So I just think it's somehow we should talk about it here as a group and get that figured out so that when this task force is appointed, they know what their goal is, what their timeline is, and what their outcome should be.
So are you wanting to put together a straw proposal, at least something to throw it on the table?
Well, I don't know. I just think it's important that, once the sale is completed, we have a group that's basically ready to go to work on it, knows what they're supposed to do, and has a timeline and when we'd like to see something back from them. So
love it. Love it.
Yeah. I just think it's
I have important. Some information I could send out if that would be okay.
Yeah, and I don't know if it should be that we talk more about it in detail here, or on the table to get, but I just really think that if we get a group and they start working on it, they come up with some plan and it ends up being runs $200,000 a year in the hole or something, maybe we might not be happy with that outcome. So, to have that clear understanding of what they should be doing.
No, I view the task force would have some charge in looking at a management structure and the sustainability question,
right,
with recommendations to the City Council and the DMCC Board.
Yeah, and I just think having them have a clear understanding of what we're looking for as they go to work is better than them coming back with something and then us correcting it then.
I would agree, because that's a charge of the committee that you're talking about, and I really think the Council should be in the lead of doing that charge.
So can you articulate or document what you think some of those key questions are that we would then have that discussion here?
I could send a memo out to Stephen that he could send out for you guys to, I don't know how you want to go about that. Or I would kind of look at is the taxi cab, their group that we just had. They had a charge, they had a goal, they had people have input on it, and they brought us back periodic updates with a final recommendation that we were able to work on and tweak to what we thought was acceptable. So that was an order, but this is just kind of that same kind of deal. Give them a real focus on it.
I did have a discussion with Tina Smith on Friday, and I can send out to you the thoughts that she passed on to me.
I think that'd be good. The only thing I wanted to say is, I think any talk about who serves on this commission or task force, whatever we're going to call it, needs to wait until we set what the objective is. So I've heard some inklings of, people around the community wanting to step up and be directed, and I respect everyone who wants to be involved. There's a ton of people that have good intentions about this product. But until the direction is set, and especially we answer some of these fundamental questions about what's this look like as a council, I don't think we set up groups or give any sort of expectation of people serving on these commissions, because if you don't know what you're signing up for, one, it sets you off on a bad foot. You might not agree with the direction that we decide to go. Let's set those, and then let's move forward.
That's exactly it. I mean, if we have people that have an idea what they're going to do, and if we're talking performing arts and we just put $10 million into the Civic Center, we say we don't really want to compete with each other, that might throw them completely off track. Yep. So I think we need to get that out clear right off the bat. Make sure that we're giving them a clear direction on which to go.
I'm sorry, I'm still recovering. You said 21.
That's what I was told.
So that seems reasonable. I think you're both saying the same thing, Mr. Campy, Mr. Ruska. Get some of those basic questions answered so that whenever this group is formed, they have some clear
and how this group is formed, too, I think. That'd be
how? Good. Yeah. Yep. Not a problem.
Okay.
All right, good.
The hat selection, or is there lottery balls like the NBA draft?
Yeah. All right, is that it for the session? All right, thanks, everyone.
Let's see. Can we just give a little update on the people that left before I
started? All right. Make sure.